This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Bookworm, a memoir of childhood reading. Written by Lucy Mangan. Read by Lucy Mangan. People say that life is the thing, but I prefer reading. American essayist and entirely correct person, Logan Pearsall Smith. I still have all my childhood books. In fact, I've spent some of my happiest hours in recent months arranging them on the bespoke bookcases I had built under the sloping ceiling of my study for their ease and comfort. I may no longer imagine them as I did 30 years ago, whispering companionably together at night when I've gone to bed, but I love them still. They made me who I am. Pallid, says my sister, peering over my shoulder as I type this. Bespectacled. Friendless. Which is also true. And yet, who needed flesh and blood friends when I had Joe March, Charlotte, Wilbur, and everyone at Mallory Towers at my beck and call? Remember hiding a book on your lap to get yourself through breakfast? Remember getting hit on the head by footballs in the playground because a game had sprung up around you while you were off in Caer Paravel? Remember taking yourself off to the furthest corner of the furthest sofa in the furthest room of the house with a stack of Enid Blytons and praying that everyone would forget about you till bedtime? Come bedtime, do you remember waiting 4 nanoseconds after the door closed before whipping out your torch and carrying on where parental stricture had required you leave off until tomorrow? Was your first crush on Dickon instead of Johnny Depp? Do you still get the urge to tap the back of a wardrobe if you find yourself alone in a strange bedroom? Or keep half an ear out at midnight for the sound of Hattie in the garden? If so, this is the book for you. But then, most books are. You are, like me, a bookworm. Little more needs to be said apart from, I hope you enjoy this memoir of my own childhood reading, and that it brings back happy memories of your own. It is a look back at the books I loved, needed, depended on, as a child. I've tried to contextualize them, give their backgrounds. Why, for example, was The Family from One End Street considered shocking by some when it first appeared? Who was the first author to use a first-person narrative in a children's book? Potted biographies of their authors, which hugely successful female children's writer whose name was not J.K. Rowling began writing only because she was desperate for money. What did E.B. White's colleagues at the hallowed New Yorker think of him producing, of all things, a children's book about a spider and a pig? And a sense of where they come in the history of children's literature. But this is a personal account of the classics and not-so-classics that shaped my world and thoughts, and so necessarily incomplete. I read omnivorously, but not well, and certainly without a thought for posterity. I read because I loved it. I read wherever I could, whenever I could, for as long as I could. At birthday parties, not least my own, I would stealthily retreat as soon as the games began to the most hidden corner of whatever house I was in, gathering any available volumes on the way and reading furiously through them until a hateful adult found me and demanded my return or, if I was lucky, told me it was home time. In the summer holidays, I could read literally from dawn till dusk, unaware of anything until forcibly recalled to real life. Those were the days, my friends. Those were the days. Do we ever manage again to commit ourselves as wholeheartedly and unselfconsciously as we do to the books we read when young? I doubt it. I have great hopes of retirement, but for the moment, as an adult of working age and a mother of a 5-year-old, life is unfortunately too much with me to allow such gorgeous, uninterrupted stretches of immersion in a book. But let us relive, for the next few chapters at least, a little of those glorious days when reading was the thing and life was only a minor inconvenience. Chapter 1. The Very Hungry Reader. I spent most of my early years, aged 1 to 3, say, being trodden on. It was your own fault, my mother explained. You were too quiet. You used to stand by my feet not making a sound while I was washing up or doing the ironing, so I'd forget you were there. What toddler does that? So I'd step back and step on you, and you still, she adds accusingly, didn't make a sound. The same tone of mingled confusion and denunciation attends her telling of another story, of the day she put me in the baby bouncer she had bought, the sort of nappy-shaped harness attached to elastic cords that you hang from a doorframe. And you just hung there. You didn't even try to bounce. Just hung there. What kind of baby does that? I think the explanation lies in the fact that I wasn't really a baby. I was a bookworm. And for the true bookworm, life doesn't really begin until you get hold of your first book. Until then, well, you're just waiting, really. You don't even know for what at that stage. If you did, you'd be making more noise about it and be less covered in court-shoe-shaped bruises. But it's books. My parents, I should say now, are Northern and Catholic. They came down south in the late 1960s to look for work. My dad, to the bafflement of his upper working class family, had wanted to work in the theatre since he were knee-high to the family whippet, or ferret, I forget. Once the most pressing of his parents' many attendant anxieties upon this fact were relieved by his acquisition of a wife, they did all they could to help him realise his dream, eventually waving him a bottle of dandelion and burdock and a bagful of clean underpants off at Preston Station to start a new life as a stage manager at the newly formed National Theatre in that there London. Mum, a recently qualified doctor, went with him, mainly to make sure he got off at the right stop. My dad was, and is, a reader. Not great at school. I once unearthed in a box full of photographs that passed to me as de facto keeper of the family archives, because once you get a reputation as bookish, all sorts of admin fall to you. A school report of his, full of barely average marks, and which read, under his failing grade for religious instruction, "Neglects to learn his catechism." Father Paedophile's thunderous fury was still evident 60 years later in every thick black stroke of his pen. But Dad was a great reader. There wasn't much money in the family, so there weren't many books in the house, apart from a few precious bound collections of boys' own comics given to Dad and his 800 siblings by a family friend after their own children grew out of them. Whoever had the most life-threatening lung disease at the time got to read them in bed until he or she got better or expired. However, in the centre of Preston sat the Harris Public Library and Museum and Art Gallery, the result of a £300,000 bequest from local lawyer and beneficiary of family railway investments, Edmund Robert Harris, in 1877. It's still there, performing all the functions its founder hoped for, a monument to civic-mindedness, and one of the countless buildings and establishments across the country that make you shake your head and wonder how much worse a state we'd be in now if we hadn't had the Victorians. And it was to the Harris Library that Dad took himself every week, working his way gradually through its offerings, until he went to the local grammar school and transferred his allegiance to the panelled library room there, where he discovered Shakespeare, Marlowe, and loads of other people who had written strangely formatted books called plays. My mother was not a reader. She was, and is, a doer. For most of my life, until she retired a few years ago, she was a gynaecologist, specialising in gruesome anecdotes and family planning. My mother is the only Catholic in history to have thrown off her upbringing utterly and never looked back. She presided over a dozen different clinics a week, swiftly building a reputation as the fastest, most efficient doctor in southeast London. "If they want to have their hands held and chat," she used to snarl at anyone who occasionally wondered if she couldn't afford to take a little more time with patients, "they can go somewhere else." At home, she was an equally efficient plumber, electrician, cleaner, laundrywoman, gardener, actually more of an operator of a scorched earth policy across the little patch of lawn and potentially herbaceous border behind our 3-bed terrace, but no matter. Neatness was the goal, not beauty. Cook, burgers, Finder's crispy pancakes, what do you want, chips or mash, and gravy. And chauffeur as needed, in ceaseless, indefatigable rotation, singing, talking to herself, or shouting orders to others all the while. My sister in later years dubbed her the Noisemaker 2000. My own theory is that if she ever has an unexpressed thought, she'll die. She was, and is, a marvel, not least because there was no martyrdom at all in any of this. Firstly, she did it because it suited her temperament, not because it fed some deep-seated complex. She's 74 at the time of writing, and still cannot be quiet or sit still for more than 20 seconds unless she's eating a tea in Coronation Street's on. Second, it was the only way she could get things done exactly to her specifications. In their utility room is a 9-volume laminated set of instructions solely about towel folding for Dad to follow if she ever goes away or he disobeys his own instructions and outlives her. And third, everyone else was required to pitch in as much as they could too. I put my toys away, and Dad, well, Dad just helped with everything. Buffered everything. Calmed everything. Mediated everything. Made sure Mum got a run out in the park every now and again to burn some energy off. Theirs was, and is, a marriage of true opposites. He will die if he ever has an express thought. It all works very well. When I was tiny, I didn't see him much because stage managing at the National Theatre takes you way past toddler bedtime. But at the weekends, once lesser activities such as eating, having baths and playing with visiting infants were out of the way, we would have a splendid time together. I am assured there was colouring, Play-Doh moulding and endless games of riding horses to Banbury Cross, but my first real memory is of Dad tucking me in beside him on the long brown floral sofa that sat on a rug dyed 3 increasingly violent shades of orange that sat on top of an orange carpet. Oh, the 1970s, may you never, never return. And opening a book almost as colourful as our sitting room. It was The Very Hungry Caterpillar, Eric Carle's paint and tissue paper collaged account of the larval Lepidoptera's metamorphosis, fueled by choice morsels of American culinary classics into butterfly. And yet, although this is the first book I remember, there must have been other books before it, because what entranced me, and millions of other readers since it was published in 1969, was the fact that it was so different from them. The caterpillar had eaten little holes through all the pages for a start, and the pages were all different sizes. Some were narrow enough to make turning them a fiddly business, some large enough to make them flappily unwieldy in tiny hands, and some were just right. They had been a fiddly business for the publisher. The Hungry Caterpillar's life began when Carle was using a hole punch on a stack of papers at his home. The little circles made him think of a bookworm, and he created a story using different-sized pages, a familiar device in Germany where his family had moved when he was six, called A Week with Willy the Worm. His editor, Anne Benedeuse, suggested that a caterpillar might be more likeable than a worm. Carle shouted, "Butterfly!" and got cracking on a rewrite that took narrative advantage of his new hero's transformative properties. Benedeuse then had to scour the globe searching for a printer that could cope with producing variously sized pages and put holes in them without bankrupting themselves or her. She eventually found one in Japan. The book emerged and has been beating its wings all over the world ever since. My father read it to me so many times that he swears when he dies we will find one slice of cake, etc., etc., engraved on his heart. You will find it written all the way through mine, like a stick of rock. Not only did I absorb it when young, I've read it many times since. Many, many, many times. Enough times to begin to appreciate at last the fathomless depths of my father's patience to my son. With no conscious effort on my part, The Very Hungry Caterpillar was his first book too. At least if you discount the cloth and crackly things he gummed on as a baby. His caterpillar was a fancy-down edition, though. It had a finger puppet attached, which can be pushed through the holes. I was not at all sure I approved of such interactive frivolity, but he was too. It was a christening present I'd put in the cupboard until he was older, and I was still too unsure of my authority as a parent to question anything too closely. It was fun, though. If you got your fingertip in there just right, you could make the puppet look almost as impudent as the real thing. I tucked my son in beside me on the sofa, and we cocooned ourselves, the ghost of my toddler self, and the spirit of my 30-something dad in a shared delight. Another delight was shared even more literally. Sugar Pink Rose was so large a hardback that it had to rest on both our laps at once. Its huge soft pink and soft grey pictures of girl elephants, boy elephants, anemones and peonies filled my entire field of vision. Written by Adela Turin and Nella Bosnia and published by a 1970s feminist collective, Sugar Pink Rose told the story of a baby girl elephant called Annabelle, who simply wouldn't turn pink like all the other baby girl elephants, no matter how many anemones and peonies she dutifully ate. These, the reader was informed, tasted disgusting. I found this hard to fathom, because both the words and the pictures were so beautiful. And instead of being happy to be shut safely in a pen and wearing a pink bonnet and pink booties like all the other girl elephants, she would look longingly at the boy elephants, who were a lovely elephant grey, as they got to eat whatever they wanted, play wherever they wanted, and to roll about in mud to their heart's content. Annabelle tries her best to turn pink and not long for freedom, but eventually can stand it no more and bursts out of her pen, casting booties and bonnet to the wind to join the boys. Gradually, the other girl elephants follow suit, and soon everyone is covered in mud, their tummies are full of sweet green grass, and they have turned the lovely grey elephant colour that nature intended. Looking back, it's just possible someone was trying to make a point. Unfortunately, it was slightly lost on me because A, I wouldn't get allegory until many years later when I read The Last Battle and suddenly realised that C.S. Lewis had been plotting Christian shenanigans all along, and B, though I shared her dislike of pink, I did not understand Annabelle's desire to leave the pen or to roll around in mud like her brothers. I liked things clean, and I liked things safe. But I loved Sugar Pink Rose, even if the finer points of the story eluded me. And 4 decades on, I love my dad for buying his 3-year-old a feminist tract. He bought my mum The Female Eunuch at about the same time. I found it on a shelf many years later and took it to university with me. On the flyleaf, he had written, "You can read this while I'm giving birth to the twins." She never did, of course. Who has time or inclination to read about the theory of feminism when you're busy putting it into practice every day? You might as well hold someone's hand and chat. A little later, Dad brought me another classic, or at least a classic in embryo. Judith Kerr's The Tiger Who Came to Tea, published in 1968, was probably only about 10 or 12 years old by the time I got my hands on it, too young yet to qualify fully as canonical. It was Kerr's first book. She had trained as an artist and was then working as a television screenwriter, and a massive instant success. It had begun life as a bedtime story invented for her two-year-old daughter, Tacy. I told it to her again and again and again, and she used to say, "Talk the tiger," Kerr remembers in her autobiography. She wrote it down, and a friend recommended that she illustrate it in bright, indelible inks rather than her customary watercolours. The tiger sprang vividly to life and rapidly into homes up and down the land. I liked Tiger very much, but my enjoyment, as you might perhaps expect from a child who read Sugar Pink Rose and basically thought, "Stay in the pen, little girl, stay in the pen," was tinged with disquiet. A tiger who just turns up without any explanation or invitation and stays for tea? Boundaries, people! My sense of propriety was offended, and the promise of domestic sanctity, upon which my childhood tranquility largely depended, had been breached. There are two types of people in this world, those who long for the arrival of the tiger at the door, and those whose profoundest wish is that nothing so unexpected happens ever. Ever, ever, ever. I have all my life been firmly in the latter category. I blame temperament and my mother, who created such an overwhelmingly safe environment at home that the idea of venturing out even into normal life has ever seemed fraught with untenable amounts of risk. Kerr herself, you sense from reading interviews with her or her autobiographical novels or her account mostly of her career in a book published a few years ago to celebrate her 90th birthday, is one of the former. She's joyful, outward-looking, generous-spirited and optimistic, despite, or perhaps because of, a very unsafe childhood spent in exile after her family fled Germany in 1933. Her father spoke out against the Nazi regime and was in imminent danger of being arrested and killed. The family received a tip-off that his passport was about to be seized, and he escaped to Switzerland just in time. Judith and her mother and brother followed, catching the milk train to Zurich on the eve of the election that brought Hitler to power. The 9-year-old Judith was only allowed to take one toy with her, and had to decide between her pink rabbit comforter and a more recent acquisition, a woolly dog. She chose the dog. Her first book for older children was published in 1971, entitled When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit. It was a remark from her second child, her son Matthew, that had prompted it. When he was 8, he was watching The Sound of Music and said, "Now we know what it was like when Mummy was a little girl." Unwilling to let this misapprehension persist, she wrote the story of 9-year-old Anna and her family watching the rise of Nazism in 1930s Germany, who has to choose between her toy dog and rabbit before they flee the country just in time. Though it doesn't gloss over the truth, it is infused with Kerr's innate optimism and by her own experience, shaped as it was by her truly heroic parents, who made the whole thing feel like such an adventure that she once exclaimed in excitement as they looked out over Paris from their tiny squalid digs, "Isn't it wonderful being a refugee?" It is this, as much as the careful tempering of the subject matter for the audience, that makes it palatable. Is that the word? Accessible, maybe. Copable with. For the young reader. But to read it again as an adult, especially bombarded with today's headlines and proliferating horrors, is to be almost undone. You bring too much to it, and long for a child's innocence to protect you once more. Mog the Forgetful Cat, Kerr's second most famous creation after the tea-guzzling tiger, was and remains a much simpler, safer proposition than the tiger or the pink rabbit. The first of what would become a long and lovely series of books based on the Kerr's own cat was written with a simple vocabulary of about 250 words, because as it was coming together, Matthew was learning to read from the Janet and John books and looked up at her one day and said, "I'm sorry, Mummy, but these books are too boring. I'm not reading them anymore." So she adapted it for him. This is parenting of the highest order. I try not to feel bad. I embraced Mog unreservedly when Dad added her to our repertoire. I was Mog. She liked to be at home with her family, with her supper, despite being a picky eater, or curled up in bed. And in Mog's Christmas, she learned to love Christmas. It was like looking in a mirror. By the time I had my child 30 years later, Kerr had very kindly written 15 more sequels, including the distinctly hallucinatory Mog in the Garden, in which she falls asleep and ends up flying through the air on a mouse-dog bird, pursued by giant birds with teeth, which, aided by the repetitive yet elliptical text that uses just 50 words to encourage children to read the book themselves, induces a feeling somewhere between, have I missed a memo, and have I accidentally smoked a spliff? Quite nice at the end of a long day. It's a measure of how deeply we revere our childhood books and the characters within them, that when in 2002 Kerr published the final book, Goodbye Mog, in which Mog dies, there was a stricken outcry, and an only slightly tongue-in-cheek and really rather touching obituary in The Guardian. She was nice but not intelligent, it read, a conservative of whom it was said she didn't like things to be exciting, she liked them to be the same. I told you, like looking in a mirror. I was 3, and life so far was excellent. Me, Mum, Dad, and an ever-increasing number of books. This perfect harmony was violently disrupted when the powers that be decided I had literally got under her feet for long enough and that it was time for me to go to nursery school. Nursery and clinic. This was still the 1970s, so going to nursery simply meant being thrown into the local church hall for a 3-hour stretch every morning to be semi-supervised by a handful of disaffected local women looking for somewhere to smoke in peace. It was miserable, but it could have been worse. At least children that age aren't keen on playing together, and our overseers didn't care enough to try and make us, so I was left largely alone. I wandered round for a few days and eventually discovered nursery's one redeeming feature, the book bin, whose contents an adult could occasionally be prevailed upon to read. It contained about 20 dog-eared paperbacks, most of which had been lost to memory, but 2 remain vivid, Frank Muir's What a Mess books and Jean de Brunhoff's Barbar the Elephant. I didn't like either of them much. The What a Mess series is about an Afghan puppy, Prince Amir of Kinjan, who is always on the brink of, or absolutely in the middle of, disaster. He tries to eat trees and dig holes in puddles, and unlike his endlessly elegant and self-possessed mother, is always covered in something sticky. People's first words to him have so often been, "What a mess," that he thinks that's his name. I found the kinetic energy of his stories quite stressful. With Barbar, I had the opposite problem. He was lumberingly dull. Jean de Brunhoff's Pachyderm, an orphan elephant whose adventures were first invented by de Brunhoff's wife, Cecile, to keep their 2 little boys amused when they were ill, was first printed in 1933 in, relatively unusually for the time, bright flat colours and a child-friendly font that looked like handwriting. I loved that font. I hated Barbar. I'd like to claim that my juvenile self took some kind of instinctive issue with the many arguments that have been made against him since the book was first published. The playwright Ariel Dorfman speaks for many critics, official and parental, when he claims that Barbar books are none other than the fulfilment of the dominant country's colonial dream. Barbar escapes his native jungle and is generously embraced and civilized by the rich, idle, if you want to see it, old lady in town. He becomes a product and ally of the very society that killed his mother in the opening pages. Green-suited and booted, he returns to his home where, in recognition of his now greater sophistication than the rest, he is made king of the elephants, and he begins to civilize them too. Houses, clothes, the accumulation of stuff, uncritical emulation of the old lady, and by extension, again, if you want to see it, the ruling class, are shown as the way to accomplish all of this. It's hard, very, very hard, not to become uncomfortable as you read it now. My son Alexander was given the collected Barbar as a present. I read the opening one to him and then, especially after noting the savage cannibals in the later Barbar's travels, quietly put it aside. The critic, Adam Gopnik, once argued in an essay that accompanied an exhibition of the Brunhoff's artwork. Jean's son Laurent continued the saga after his father's early death in 1937, that Barbar is not an unconscious instance of the French colonial imagination, but a self-conscious comedy about the French colonial imagination, which I thought as I pushed it a little more firmly to the back of Alexander's bookcase may be totally objectively true, but not to a 4-year-old. As I say, I would like to claim that I instinctively grasped and recoiled from the whole 4 legs good, 4 legs clothed, driven everywhere and returning to the homeland in triumph better vibe, but in truth it was just his dullness. If What a Mess was too much, Barbar was too little. He is a very boring hero. Patient, industrious, and for all his eventual willingness to hand off responsibility to Cornelius while he goes on balloon rides, basically an adult soul in a child elephant's body. Honestly, whose first thought when they pitch up in an unimagined, unexplored city is to buy a suit of clothes? And events just happen, one after the other. Nobody explains anything, has feelings about, or motives for anything. It's a book that depends on charm to sweep you along. I found it cold. And now that it's become colonially suspect for me too, I suspect the Gallic elephant and I will stay forever at a distance. Why then do they stick in my mind? It's because they were the ones that revealed to me the bookworm's prime directive. Any book is better than no book. Always. You don't necessarily have to enjoy the book, though obviously that's the ideal and most books are enjoyable, as long as the space inside you that can only be filled by reading is receiving the steady stream of words for which it constantly hungers. So Wattemess, Barbar and I were bound. They and their companions in the book bins alleviated some of the drudgery of nursery school. I largely had them to myself, and both staff and children happily left me to my own devices until my mother arrived at the end of the morning like a miniature tornado to gather me up and sweep me off with her to her afternoon clinics. Whichever clinic it was, the procedure was the same. I would sit in a corner behind the reception desk, trotting to and fro between my little chair and the books that had been provided by the council or donors in the futile hope of keeping children occupied, while doctors took their mothers into their rooms to work out with them the best way of preventing more. As pills were issued, injections given, and diaphragms checked for seaworthiness, I was benignly supervised by Joy or Gwen, who ran the place. And by the place, I mean the clinic, the health centre it was in, the NHS, and possibly most of South East London. Over the years, they became firm family friends, and from the earliest days, they were my protectors. My mother would emerge from her room to call another patient in and roar at me, a three-year-old sitting so quietly in the corner that I should have been the occasion of medical concern rather than fury, to behave myself. Joy or Gwen would roar back that I was an angel, under their jurisdiction, and she should get back in her room forthwith. It was most gratifying. Even more gratifying were the books on offer. There were not many per clinic, but there were many clinics. During those early tours of Lewisham and North Southwark's gynaecology and family planning departments, I made many friends besides Joy, Gwen, and assorted kindly nurses. Spot the Dog, Harry McClary, Elmer the Elephant, and above all, Miffy, who said the most by saying nothing. A design classic, 85 million copies of the 30-odd books by Dick Bruner, starring the world's most featureless yet boundlessly expressive rabbit, have been sold since she first appeared in 1955. Forget your Titians and your Michelangelos. To look into Miffy's face, two dots for eyes and a cross for a mouth comprising a face that somehow looked back at me with happiness, sadness, anticipation, bewilderment, surprise and all points in between, even if I didn't have a name for them yet, is to appreciate the infinite power of art. I loved Miffy. I still love Miffy, even if these days she seems to gaze back at me with just one expression, which hovers somewhere between eternal reproach and sad resignation. But I think we're both hoping for better times to come. Best of all were the clinics that had Shirley Hughes. I couldn't read the words to Lucy and Tom's adventures yet, or Dogger's, or those of the many other books she illustrated but were written by someone else, but I didn't need to. I fell into her warm, untidy drawings wherever I found them, with a sigh of satisfaction, responding instantly to the evocative gifts of a brilliant draftswoman, who, as she once said of her hero Edward Ardizzone, with just a few lines of pencil, could open up this astonishing depth in illustration. Hughes's pictures were a riot of autumnal colours rather than monochromatic like his, but her books and her world was full to overflowing and endlessly appealing. I warm also to the story of how she once spent hours entertaining children at a book fair in the north of England by drawing dozens and dozens of pictures for them in thick black felt tip. Now, she said at the end of her Stakhanovite stint, any questions? One little boy put up his hand. Yes, Missy said. Where's the colours? I got general delight from almost every book I came across, but hers were perhaps the first time I felt the sense of a specific need being met. I disliked profoundly being away from home. Nursery was the worst, of course, but even at the clinic, with Mum in her office and kindly protectors all round, I was always unsettled and fretting inwardly until we were in the car going home. Then the small, gnawing worries, sometimes at the pit of my stomach, sometimes deep in my brain, sometimes both. At nursery, they talked to each other up and down my esophagus. As nameless as they were insistent, would start to lessen as the car ate up the miles between me and safety, and finally cease completely once I set foot over my own threshold again. But until that true safety could be gained, Hughes provided a fine proxy. I wanted to press my face on the pictures, but generally managed to refrain. Her interiors were every home. Not chaotic, but comfortably messy, well-appointed, but not luxurious, recognisably contemporary but not aggressively modern. Hughes is a specialist in making the domestic and quotidian attractive. They contain something elemental, an intimation of what we all mean by home. I could live here temporarily, without too much fretting and anxiety. My mother would know where to find me. The notion that books could provide succour as well as entertainment was born, and my adoration and my need for them grew accordingly. I did eventually start to read as well as simply gaze adoringly at most of Hughes's stories a few years later, but somehow I either overlooked Dogger or simply failed to appreciate it then for the masterpiece it is. The book won the 1977 Kate Greenaway Medal and made Hughes's name as an author-illustrator. I didn't remedy my lack until I bought it a couple of years ago for Alexander. A word of warning. Do not read Dogger as an adult unless you are in peak mental and physical condition. It will break you. The story of Dave and his lost toy dog, accidentally sold to another child at the school fair, turns on a selfless act of kindness by his big sister, Bella. If you're a grown-up reading this for the first time, you will be caught unawares, and soon your bewildered three-year-old will have let himself out of the bedroom and gone looking for his father to, "Come and help Mummy, she's crying, tears and snot." It's a book you long to become your child's favourite so you can read it night after night, despite the pivotal scene in which Bella nobly trades the giant bear she has won in her three-legged race with the little girl who bought Dave's dog, tearing a new layer off your heart every time, because you want him to absorb the lessons it offers. Like all the best books, as adjunct and never as didactic driver of the plot, into the very marrow of his bones. Of course my own child has never fulfilled this longing. He likes Dogger now and again, but it doesn't own him as I would like it to. But we have nevertheless read it many, many times over the last couple of years, and it's still all I can do not to lie prostrate on the ground with grief, crying, "Look, look what we're capable of, if only we would try. Oh, humanity, what's wrong with us? What's wrong with the world?" Motherhood is very difficult. Back in 1977, an indisputably good thing was at last about to emerge from the nursery situation. One lunchtime, the woman my mother occasionally asked to pick me up forgot to do so, so one of the supervisors walked me home. No one, of course, was in. So, with the robust approach to child safety that characterised the era, she left me next door with a neighbour I'd never met. Her name was Jenny, and her house contained a lovely smell of baking. A large slice of cake with blue icing was soon pushed into my hand, and there was a tiny two-year-old child, also called Lucy, who lived there. I loved her immediately and have not stopped yet. Jenny still lives next door to my parents, and Lucy and I live 10 minutes from each other and them. We are very alike. We both like to stay in, wear three jumpers at all times, watch telly, not talk, and sleep a lot. Our only real difference is that I also like to read, and she prefers to put on a fourth jumper and another DVD instead. At this point in history, however, Lucy's antipathy to reading was not yet apparent, and so she had a bookshelf above her dresser that groaned with such delights as a full set of Jan Pienkowski's Megan Mogg books and Roger Hargreaves' Mr. Men. Over the next few years, it would become a rich resource for me. Lucy gave me free rein, and I went round there a lot to borrow and exchange various volumes and take them home to Dad so we could marvel anew at the length of Mr. Tickle's arms. He was the first in the series. Hargreaves made him up as a bedtime story for his son Adam, and then thought, hey, I might have something here. The number of eggs Mr. Strong could eat, and the heart-rending ceaseless clumsiness of Mr. Bump. Rereading the Mr. Men now with my son, and it was Lucy Donovan who brought him the full box set for his third birthday, is a discombobulating experience. The stories that once wholly enraptured me stand revealed, usually, as miserably flawed, broken-backed things. Maybe one in five comprises something that actually qualifies as a plot. The rest leave you hanging in midair, wondering what kind of blackmail material Hargreaves had on his editors that they allowed this to pass muster. At the same time, the drawings remain as thoroughly and elementally satisfying as ever. Hargreaves drew, as far as both my 3 and 43-year-old selves are concerned, the platonic ideals of fried eggs, of shoes, of houses, trees, washerwomen and wizards. And his colours are right. Of course uppityness is plum purple. Of course happiness is yellow. And of course ticklishness is orange. I just wonder, 612 rereads into 50 books, what colour Mr. Satisfactory Narrative Resolution would have been. The birth of illustrated children's books. Life, even including nursery school, had settled down nicely again. And then came Der Struwwelpeter, or Shock-Headed Peter. Dad just brought home this book full of bloody thumb stumps, deaths by drowning and carbonized children who played with matches all in saturated color and heavy black ink one day as if it was nothing. When in fact Heinrich Hoffmann's 1845 creation, which he wrote for his three-year-old son one Christmas when he'd not been able to find any book in the shops that he wanted to buy, was a hellscape from which parts of my wounded psyche are still struggling to emerge. The ear could no more refuse to hear the burrowing insistent rhymes. Oh, that awful insinuating cat chorus in the dreadful story of Harriet and the Matches. Meow, they said. Meow, meow. You'll burn to death if you do so. Your parents have forbidden you, you know. Then the eye could drag itself away from the jagged, evocative, full-colour illustrations accompanying shock-headed Peter and his companion's travails. How Hoffman's own tender toddler responded is not recorded. Maybe they breed them tougher in Germany. I hope so. It came as no surprise to me to learn in later years that Hoffman ran a lunatic asylum. At the time of my first exposure to this beast of a book, however, I had no recourse to facts that might validate my unease. I simply turned to the man who had brought it so carelessly into our lives and gazed at him with large, unblinking eyes, the better to let him read the horror now contained forever therein, until he closed the book and put it on a high shelf. No, higher, higher again, until I was much, much older. Until shock-headed Peter arrived, the world of books and my dad reading to me had been divided neatly into two halves. One comprised the bright, simple books about cats, elephants, caterpillars and children dressed like me, and the other comprised books in more muted colours but full of much busier pictures. There was gilding, there were curlicues, there were more rhymes and less prose. When I got a little older, I would label them the now and the then books. Now meant modern. Then meant what I would only much later come to understand were the lush fruits of the great 19th century collaborations between Edmund Evans, Walter Crane, Randolph Caldecott and Kate Greenaway. Together they invented children's picture books in the format we recognise today. Of course there had been picture books, or at least books with pictures, for children, before Evans and his gang found each other. Even the earliest books for children in the 15th and 16th centuries generally managed to squeeze a few crude woodcut illustrations onto the pages. And in 1658, John Amos Comenius stepped things up a bit by publishing the Orbis Sensualium Pictus, a sort of early encyclopedia which had a picture of an object at the top of each page and its name in Latin and English below. But that was just the beginning of the good times. A new lottery book of birds and beasts for children to learn their letters by was published in 1771, with the letters on the left-hand side of every spread and a pair of suitable pictures for each on the right. These were woodcuts, but done by the absolute master of the art, Thomas Bewick. His pictures bear as much relation to the massy, indistinct stuff children had been used to as Dr. Scholl's sandals do to Louboutin's. When you look at them, or the illustrations from his most famous book, A History of British Birds, intended for adults but doubtless pored over by children too, the mind simply boggles to think that it is not done with pen, ink and hand, but by drawing onto wood and carefully cutting away with infinitesimal care to different depths, to leave the picture in relief and the block to take up, if of course the printer is as careful and as skilled at his craft as you are at yours, different amount of inks in order to reproduce all the different gradations of blackness and bring all your precious details to life. As long as I don't think about it, I could look at them forever. If I do, I very soon have to go for a lie down. Still, I hope the children of the 18th century appreciated his efforts. The Brontes owned a copy of A History of British Birds and by all accounts cherished it. Then again, so would you if it was the only thing available to take your mind off the TB-ridden siblings dropping all around you like flies. Then, in 1789, into this occasionally beautiful but defiantly monochrome world of woodcuts, rode the poet and painter William Blake, with 19 poems collectively entitled Songs of Innocence, printed, elaborately illustrated, and exuberantly hand-coloured by the author himself. It was perhaps the first book, if not for children, then still eagerly consumed by them, whose pictures did not simply reflect the words on the page, but evoked and added to them. It is, of course, easier to do this in a book of poems about the innocence of childhood than it is in an ABC primer or natural history book. A D is a D and a duck is a duck. You'd be looking at a mallard a long time before you were reminded of a numinous state of being. Nevertheless, Blake really went for it. Even coming from a technicolour age as we do, the illustrations are still quite overwhelming, as perhaps befits a man who thought of the imagination as the body of God. I miss mad artists. There are times when Grayson Perry doesn't quite cut it, you know? This new idea of pictures enriching and adding to a story rather than straightforwardly depicting what was being said wasn't followed up right away. In the Victorian era, toy books became popular. Sixpence or a shilling got you half a dozen or a dozen 5 by 6 inch pages, whose colourful illustrations dominated, not to say simply overwhelmed, the text, which is usually a fairy story or a condensed adult tale like Robinson Crusoe. In 1865, the publishers Routledge and Warne hired Edmund Evans, a man whose talent and painstaking work in wood engraving and colour printing had made him a name to reckon with in the world of publishing, to make them some toy books. Little did they know they were inaugurating what would become known as the first golden age of children's book illustration. Evans, a man with artistic vision as well as commercial nous, felt deeply that the still crude pictures then being used to illustrate children's books could be improved upon without impoverishing everyone involved and bankrupting firms. He simply had to be able to justify a big enough print run to provide sufficient economy of scale, which meant producing something beautiful enough that people would want to buy it in droves, which would be expensive, but practicable if you could do a big enough print run, which you could do because you were producing something beautiful enough that you get, I'm sure, the point. To this beautiful and economically sound end, he first commissioned Walter Crane, an artist he had worked with on adult yellowbacks, inexpensive books with yellow covers for adults and sold at railway stations, also known as penny dreadfuls or mustard plasters. They were often recovered editions of previously unsold books. Evans realised you could shift them if you commissioned good enough artists to repackage them irresistibly. Crane shared Evans' belief in the importance of giving children the best experience possible. We all remember the little cuts that coloured the books of our childhood. The ineffaceable quality of these early pictorial and literary impressions affords the strongest plea for good art in the nursery and schoolroom, he once wrote. Between 1865 and 1886, they collaborated on around 50 books, starting with relatively simple affairs like the nursery rhymes This is the House that Jack Built and Sing a Song of Sixpence, before moving on to richer, more fertile fare like the fairy tale Beauty and the Beast. The market exploded. Evans had been right. If you print it, they will come. Especially if they are a population beginning to feel the mind and literacy expanding effects of recent educational reforms, living in an era of growing affluence, and characterised by a rising middle class desperate to spend their newfound wealth on further self-improvement. The late 1800s were a perfect picture book producing storm. By 1871, Crane had moved abroad, but he and Evans still managed to produce 2 or 3 books a year, exchanging illustrations, proofs and finished pictures by post, as if the process of transferring picture to woodblock to page in full colour were not already laborious enough. Not for the first time, you have to applaud the can-do, will-do, why-the-hell-would-we-not-do spirit of the age. And by the end of the decade, Crane and Evans were flying, and confident enough to produce books so elaborate that they barely qualified as toy books at all. In 1878, they published The Baby's Opera, a book of old rhymes with new dresses. Made up of 56 pages, a nursery rhyme on each, a dozen of which are fully illustrated, and all the rest of which have decorative borders round the rhymes and music. My own childhood picture books have, alas, long since vanished. Victims, I can only presume, of my mother's constant mission to maintain a house that shows no sign of human habitation. Even now, after 40 years in the same place, you would not be able to guess a single thing about the people who live there, apart, possibly, from the fact that there must be at least one monomaniac who has forgotten more about decluttering than Marie Kondo will ever know. But when I looked up The Baby's Opera online, its illustrations are so familiar that I think I must have owned a copy. Maybe as part of an anthology, I seem to feel a substantial weight in my hands as I scroll through them on screen. Fruiting plants in delicate yellow, orange and green grow up the sides of oranges and lemons, while a row of children ring bells below. Children in clothes and a garden tinted an unmistakable azure sit beneath lavender's blue. A liberal scattering of cockle shells and smiling flowers answer the question of how does my garden grow? An intertwined gathering of crocodiles, puppy dogs and snails are similarly provided in response to what a little boy is made of. It's completely beautiful. No wonder it sold 10,000 copies in a month. Both it and its companion 2 years later, The Baby's Bouquet, a fresh bunch of old rhymes and tunes, looked like miniature medieval illuminated manuscripts and went on to sell hundreds of thousands of copies. Eventually, however, the prolific Crane needed a rest, and Evans brought in an illustrator called Randolph Caldecott, whose work he had admired in magazines. With Caldecott, children's picture books took a giant leap forward. Crane's drawings had been charming and immensely attractive, but as one contemporary put it, he knows too much and has not enough inspiration. There was a carefulness, a pedestrian quality to his pictures that you might not notice while you were being beguiled, until and unless, perhaps, they're set alongside Caldecott's. Suddenly, Crane is static where Caldecott is vibrant and fluid. You can better imagine life for his creations continuing, while Crane's are consigned to oblivion once you've turned the page. Here was the man who could pick up where Blake left off, adding another layer of complexity to texts and deepening the delights on offer. Caldecott's work heralds the beginning of the modern picture book, wrote a man who should know, the writer and illustrator of his own and other books for children, Maurice Sendak, many years later. Words are left out, but the picture says it. Pictures are left out, but the word says it. Sendak also noted that his pictures conveyed a subtle darkness. You can't say it's a tragedy, but something hurts, like a shadow passing quickly over. It is this which gives a Caldecott book, however frothy the verses and pictures, its unexpected depth. There's an expression on the face of the wife of the hard-working linen draper in the poem The Diverting History of John Gilpin that demonstrates this perfectly. The verse explains that she laments the fact they have not been on holiday, though wedded we have been these twice 10 tedious years. Her face is the face of benignly neglected and frustrated wives down the ages. Marriage, it says, is a long game, a mixed bag, an endurance test. More often than not, something hurts. All of which goes some way to explaining why there is a Caldecott medal, with a relief of the cover of The Diverting History of John Gilpin on the front and of 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie on the back, awarded every year by the Association for Library Service to Children, to the illustrator of the most distinguished American picture book for children, rather than a Crane medal. It commemorates the man who brought the genre to maturity. Caldecott published 2 books a year with Evans for nearly a decade, including a set of 12 books of nursery rhymes that sold nearly 1 million copies and made him internationally famous by the time he died in 1886. The third gilder of this golden age of illustration began her career as a poet. In the late 1870s, Kate Greenaway persuaded her father to show Evans her manuscript for a book of verse called Under the Window. I was at once fascinated by the originality of the drawings and the ideas of the verse, so I at once purchased them, said Evans. And in 1879 he persuaded Routledge to publish the book and engrave the necessary blocks himself. He then had 20,000 copies printed, an absurd number for an untried author-illustrator's first book, and he was roundly ridiculed for it. But what do you know? They sold out before he even had time to reprint. But reprint he did, and on they sold, 100,000 altogether, kicking off the Greenaway vogue, as more and more children, and crucially, their parents, fell in love with her pastoral portraits of an idyllic, timeless English countryside, populated by endlessly innocent children, clothed in her own cod if you were feeling mean, and if you are, I suggest you go away and look at some more Kate Greenaway pictures until the feeling in your savage breast subsides, versions of late 18th century and Regency fashions. I do not know why I cared to draw children in old-fashioned dresses, she once wrote to a fan who inquired, except that old-fashioned things were always very pleasing to me. They were evidently pleasing to many others, too. Her style became part and parcel of the liberal arts and crafts fashion of the time, chiming with the contemporary reverence for and hankering after past simplicities and kinder times. In the 1890s, the department store Liberty, the retail mothership of overeducated late Victorian bohemians, produced their first ever line of children's wear based on her pictorial costumes, and a whole generation of a certain type of mother delightedly mob-capped, aproned, pinafore-smocked and bonneted their daughters. How their daughters felt about this is not recorded. Her popularity soared with every book she published. She did 2 or 3 every year for Evans, usually with print runs of 150,000, the most famous of which included Mother Goose and The Pied Piper of Hamelin. Most critics, then and since, have agreed that as a poet, Kate Greenaway was a very good artist. But her art, too, was not at the time, and certainly not since, universally adored. Caldecott, admittedly, she ain't. As Beatrix Potter put it, she can't draw. Greenaway's entry in the International Companion Encyclopedia of Children's Literature puts it slightly more kindly. Her figures, it notes, tend to have no bodies under their clothes. The Kate Greenaway Medal for Illustration was founded more in recognition of her popularity than her skill, though I should point out it's not and never has been awarded on that basis. I see exactly what they mean, and yet I know I would have been, I was, I am, a member of the masses who loved her unconditionally. I like to think I would have stopped short of forcibly mob-capping any offspring I had to hand, but oh, I want to live in her idealised never-never world so much. If I had been a child immersed in their works during those golden years, rather than just dipping into whatever anthologised bits and pieces I have that are now lost to memory, I think I would have adored but eventually exhausted Crane, and only confronted his successor when I was feeling particularly alert and energetic. I would have been glad and grateful to have, effectively, two Caldecott books, words and pictures, for the price of one. But they would have been right only for special times and places. Greenaway would have had my heart. It is telling that when I have the chance of buying copies or prints of the three for Alexander, I have only ever opted for Greenaway. She seems to be the middle ground, and perhaps that was some of the secret of her success. She offers a more detailed, immersive world than Crane, but without Caldecott's cleverness and shadows. She speaks to the escapist in all of us, who wants to be charmed, not challenged. We're a lazy, mob-capped mob. But it's all so lovely there. Once Evans and his trio had pointed the way, other artists followed in their talented droves, and the genre flourished. Arthur Rackham, Edmund Dulac, and Kay Nielsen dominated the early decades of the 20th century, and gave birth to the tradition of the lavishly illustrated gift book for children. My adult eye cannot discern much difference between them unless I see them side by side, when it becomes apparent that Dulac and Nielsen prefer more subtle colours and have a slightly more exotic touch to them. But my heart can still pick out a Rackham image at 40 paces. I first came across his eerie twilight fairy world in the study of a family friend. I was 4 or 5 and I think I must have been put there while the adults were drinking. We're still in the late 1970s at this point. I, with difficulty, opened a gorgeous, massively heavy book that was on the floor by the desk and was confronted by all manner of sinuous, twisted horrors, made all the worse by the fact I had no names for them. Gothic trees and grotesque spirits intertwined. All the women had too much hair and too much gown flowing round them. How did they think they were going to escape when the next wizened dwarf or bony beast extracted itself from the fearsome forest and came after them? Especially with all those sinister pools everywhere, bathed in an even more sinister light from suns set too low in the sky. This kind of thing shouldn't happen to a Greenaway fan. I slammed the book shut and sat quietly, waiting for the 1970s to end, so that my parents would stop abandoning me to terrors like this. Rackham and I have managed a rapprochement since, but I keep my wits about me. When I'm in the rambling Norfolk farmhouse of my dreams, with the freedom at last to shelve my entire book collection as it should be shelved, I will file a Greenaway volume somewhere nearby to counteract the horrors lurking within. Other people plan retirement cruises and look forward to dandling grandchildren on their knees. This is what I do. The two world wars disrupted everything, of course, as wars do, and the accompanying shortages and austerity dampened publishing's lustre for a while. But when mental and practical resources began to return, a new generation of children's picture book authors and illustrators began to make its presence felt. One of its members was Maurice Sendak. Sendak. I usually remember the first time and place I meet a book. Not with this one. I've no idea where or when I first met Where the Wild Things Are, except that I must have been very young and that there were children somewhere vaguely in the distance carrying on with their normal lives as I held the book open at the double-page spread in the middle. The wild rumpus fills it from edge to edge, as Max's imaginary world effaces his reality, just as the book was effacing mine. The wild thing's yellow eyes stared out at me, daring me to shut the book, daring me to keep reading. It was the darkest book I had ever seen. Literally so, because it was all heavy greens, cross-hatched browns and shadowy greys, which really make monstrous yellow eyes pop. And metaphorically because, well, because Sendak's motivating force had always been his great curiosity about childhood as a state of being and how all children manage to get through childhood from one day to the next, how they defeat boredom, fear, pain and anxiety, and find joy. In Wild Things, he went rootling around in his own and the collective subconscious for answers. Max, in his wolf suit, begins the story, as some long-buried, possibly still bruised part of you probably knows, by making mischief of one kind and another, and is sent to bed without his supper and with the admonishment, "Wild thing." Soon, Max's room is transformed into a jungle, and he sets sail, in and out of weeks, to a land full of wild things, becomes their king, and bids the wild rumpus start. But unexpectedly soon, he has had enough, and sails back to where someone loved him best of all. He is restored to his room, and finds supper waiting for him, still, famously, hot. It's a book about abandonment, about testing the depth and strength of feelings and learning to control them. It's a book about love and hate and power and powerlessness, and the wild things they make us do and the wild places they open up within us. It's about the power of dream worlds and the porousness of the boundary between them and reality for children. A drawing of a monster on Max's bedroom wall foreshadows the coming creatures. The same crescent moon hangs in the sky outside his room and over the land where the wild things are, at least until the wild rumpus starts, when it becomes, because it would, wouldn't it, full. He remains in his wolf suit in both worlds, but the hood slips off as he returns home, and his animal fury and freedom abates. Sendak drew his inspiration for the wild things themselves from the memory of his older Jewish relatives coming to visit. They couldn't speak English, and they grabbed and twisted your face, and they thought that was an affectionate thing to do. He and his siblings formulated the theory that, as their mother's cooking was so terrible, the relatives could well be planning to eat them instead. We couldn't taste any worse than what she was preparing. There was also a dash of King Kong in there, too. A friend of Sendak's once pointed out that the composition of one of the illustrations exactly matched a scene from the film Sendak saw as a child in the 1930s. It was lauded by many, and won that year's Caldecott Medal, but it was also accused of being too frightening for children, an inappropriate and unhelpful acknowledgement of unspoken fears. Other critics seemed to miss the point entirely. The reviewer in Publishers Weekly praised the illustrations, but not the pointless and confusing story. And some parents didn't seem to know what to think. One woman told Sendak she had read it to her daughter 10 times, and the girl had screamed every time. Why, Sendak wondered, had she kept on if her daughter had found it so distressing? It's a Caldecott book, the woman replied. She's supposed to like it. I feel for this woman. I can't tell you how long I tried to make Alexandra enjoy Graham Oakley's Church Mice books. They're so dryly witty, such deft characterization. Who doesn't know an Arthur? And isn't there a little of Samson the Cat, his instinctive urges forever poised to undo all the good of his early training in all of us? The whole series captures the gentle stoicism of the Anglican Church like nothing else, I used to cry, until the day I realized that Alexander was A, too, and B, asleep. But for Sendak there were, and have been ever since, enough fans like the 8-year-old boy who wrote to him soon after the book's publication to ask how much it cost to travel to the wild things, because, if it's not too expensive, my sister and I would like to go there for the summer. Sendak's favourite fan, though, was a little boy who sent him a card with a little drawing on it. Out of respect for a fellow artist, Sendak went to some trouble with his reply and included a little drawing of his own of a wild thing to the boy. He got a letter back from the boy's mother, which said, "Jim loved your card so much, he ate it." Sendak considered it the highest compliment he had ever been paid. He didn't care that it was an original Morris Sendak drawing or anything. He saw it, he loved it, he ate it. And I couldn't even bring myself to press my face against a Shirley Hughes picture. Go, Jim. You go, son, for all of us. Morris Sendak, the author, illustrator, nonpareil. Where the Wild Things Are landed in my childhood with as little warning and as big an impact as it did in the world of children's books when it was first published in 1963. Its creator had grown up as the sickly son of a tailor in Brooklyn, who started drawing to pass the time on the backs of the cardboard stiffeners his father packed each finished shirt around. He had come to prominence as an illustrator in the 50s with A Hole is to Dig by Ruth Krauss, a collection of genuine definitions like toes are to wiggle, hats are to wear on a train, she had gathered from real children and which were crying out for accompanying drawings that could do unsentimental justice to their straightforward innocence. 4 years later, Sendak had taken the leap into writing as well as illustrating, with Kenny's Window, Very Far Away, The Sign on Rose's Door, and The Nutshell Library. All of them have distinctively Sendakian heroes and heroines, who are by turns sulky, angry, passive, lovable and charming, but always fully, uncompromisingly, themselves. And they share that lovely chunky look of all his child characters, which Sendak once described as looking as if they'd been hit on the head and hit so hard they weren't ever going to grow anymore. He attributed it to the slightly hunched look that he had seen many of his childhood companions developed in unconscious defence against the vicissitudes of immigrant life in 1930s Brooklyn. Whatever the inspiration, you can always tell a Sendak child from its low centre of gravity, and the sense that it would take the application of severe physical force to deflect it from its goal. As a child who spent much of every morning being flung out of the way by children markedly younger than myself before I reached the sucker of the book bin corner, I admired them very much. All his books had done well, and Sendak was respected in his field. Then came The Wild Things that would make him a legend. For a few years after Where the Wild Things Are, Sendak concentrated again on illustrating other people's work,